Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. So no set schedule, just pretty much when I finished it, review the book, stick it up on the podcast feed for you to listen to. Just a quick note that you're listening now to episode number 30, I think it is. I did actually start recording this a while ago, well, about 15 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago, and I did a little bit of feedback at the beginning of the episode. The thing is, the feedback went a little bit longer than I was expecting, so I decided to put that across as 29 and a half, show 29 and a half sort of feedback from the Snow Crash episode I did, because it was some good feedback, and I had more to say on the topic even then, so... If you haven't read that, or maybe if you've skipped your iTunes, skipped over it by accident, I'm not sure what happens there, go back and listen to it. I might refer to it again as I'm doing this review, because there was a few things that I wanted to mention again about this book in there. So anyway, let's just move straight on now. The book that I'm reviewing now, Peter F. Hamilton's The Dreaming Void, published in last year, 2007, and it's about 800 pages long. 795 pages long. So a big, big, chunky book there. It's going to actually be a little bit tricky for me to review this book in detail, story-wise, because it's the first book in a trilogy. And while I could, you know, normally I would go into the story about as much as it would go up to roughly around about maybe 100 pages in. And in a normal length book, that's about a quarter of the way into the story. Maybe if something happens after 100 pages, I consider it to be a spoiler. The thing is, because this is the first part, like the first third of a long book, you know, the events that happen in this book would normally be the things that I'd talk about happening in the first 100 pages of another book. The thing is, because there's so many different threads to this story, so many different characters going through the story, it's difficult for me to talk about all of their, you know, all of their stories in detail because, you know, just take a huge amount of time. Yet at the same time, it feels very much like it's the setup for the next books in the series. You know, even though, you know, the story does move on and you do get some places and it does develop quite a lot, it definitely feels like, okay, this is not a standalone book in the slightest. Not even a little bit. Although, to be honest, if I never read the continuing books of these, it would be very frustrating, but I'd be happy just to stop where I am now. But of course, I'm not going to. At the same time, as all that said, you know, this isn't just the first in the series. It's actually, this series of three books is a continuation of another three books set in the same universe. Let me just quickly flick to the front of the book because it'll be on the front page. Ah, yes, here it is. So there was a book that was set in like the early 21st century, around about, what, 2020, a little bit later than that, I guess. And it was called Misspent Youth, and it was about the development of, well, first of all, it was a lot about the development of, like, society and things like that, but two specific kind of technologies. One was the development of computer storage. So if everyone can have infinite storage, what does copyright mean? And there was this whole idea of post-10. So in 2010, this new form of storage, like infinite storage, came around. And then after that, the world was changed because you didn't ever have to create anything new before listening to other. It was a weird idea. Anyway, it was good stuff. The other thing was like life extension. So it was Misspent Youth. It was about somebody regaining their youth, being sort of refreshed and re-lifed and put into a new body again. Someone with an old mind being put into a new body. And it was quite an interesting book, although I didn't actually like it so much because the characters in the book weren't that likable, which is a real pity, because that's one of Peter F. Hamilton's real strong points normally, is that I really like his characters. Anyway, so then set hundreds of years and after that, there was another sort of two books, big chunky books this time around, called in the Commonwealth Saga, Pandora's Star and Judas Unchanged. Unchanged. Sorry. Skipping around with my pronunciations here, not very well at all. And, so anyway, this sort of adds in a whole lot more, because it sort of starts not too long after the end of the first book, the Misspent Youth book, but it skips forward quite a lot, because it sort of introduced wormhole technology, sort of like, so you can travel from planet to planet, from solar system to solar system, instantaneously. And I really like this, because the way that they do it, they set up a wormhole there, and it would be always fixed in one place. So the easiest and quickest and cheapest way of getting things through the wormhole was by trains. So, you know, and then it would come out the wormhole on the other end, and then you could change the destination of wormholes to other things. So a train could just go in, and then they'd flick the destination of the wormhole, and another train would go in, go somewhere different. And so it was really interesting to have sort of like a whole society set up but still going back to trains and things like that, which I guess, you know, Misspent Youth, was there was also train kind of themes in there as well. It was used there. So I could see how these two things connected really well. Of course, they introduce into it artificial intelligence, into the universe there, like a large commonwealth of different planets as well, like with the inner systems and the outer systems, and then each outer system will slowly become an inner system, and then they'd always push forward and further out and things like that. Of course, until they go up against a... they find something out in the distance, and it's a really, really cool and scary and evil enemy in the form of an alien. And I really like this alien, but again, if I told you much about it, it would give it away. So they defeat the enemy and everything like that, because Peter F. Hamilton, the good guys win. We're not talking Ian M. Banks here, where the good guys probably are going to die before the end of the book and stuff like that. So, so this book, this Dreaming Void, is set 1,500 years after this world that's already there. So you've got this fantastic sense of history. You know, hints of this past world are made, and references go back to it, and they're talking about the Starflyer War, which is this huge war in the previous books there, in the Commonwealth Saga books. And they had actually had the same kind of thing in the Commonwealth Saga books as well, going like referencing back to some of the events in Misspent Youth. It wasn't just referencing back to the same world. It was actually talking about, you know, some of the characters. And the same thing happens here. So fantastic sense of history. At the same time, some of the characters from the previous book, because the characters can be re-lifed and they can become young again and they can download their memories and then reload memories back into a new body, you've got some of the same characters returning. Other characters don't return, but again, those people are sort of talked about that they're sort of legends of the old world. You know, there's this character in the Commonwealth Saga cycle of books, or two books, called Ozzy, and he's one of the main characters there. But he invented the wormhole technology and went on to become, you know, another inventor and do other kind of things as well. But a very eccentric guy. In this book, the name Ozzy is the swear word. So you go, oh, for Ozzy's sake, or, you know, for the sake of Ozzy, or, you know, Ozzy above, you know, it's sort of like the kind of way of saying Jesus Christ, you know, it's like Ozzy, wow, like that. And I really like that. Although he definitely does exist in this book, because one of the characters is a friend of theirs and said, oh yeah, I met him a few years ago, and everyone's going, oh, you met Ozzy, yeah. And it's like, yeah, but it's just me. So, like I say, you could probably read this book, The Dreaming Void, without reading these other books in the Commonwealth Saga, but it probably wouldn't spoil this book so much, because you'd be able to pick up and, you know, it references history, but other books reference history that happens that you never actually get to know about. For example, Dune, you know, they're talking about the huge, you know, the wars, the machine wars that happened beforehand and all those other kind of things. And you don't need to know about it, and sometimes it's best not to. For example, Dune, when you find out what happened in advance, you're just like, I don't actually care about what happens in advance. I guess same with Star Wars, you know, going back to movie references, the Clone Wars. It's like, wow, the Clone Wars. And then you actually find out about them, it's like, Clone Wars, you know. So you read the book, you'll enjoy it, but it'll probably spoil the previous books. You know, you'd get away with reading Misspent Youth, no problem at all, but the Commonwealth Saga, you know, the Pandora Star, Judas Unchained, it would spoil those books for you, I'm quite sure. Like I say, 1,500 years after that, you know, lots more things have been introduced. For example, there's more planets, but not that many more, actually, because people go inwards. They actually start migrating inwards. I'll get into that in a second as well. Because some people can be brought back to life, you know, and other people are still alive, people in the last books, you actually, you know, meet them again. Sorry, I'm going off, missed a note here as well. Going back to the previous books, you know, some books, some of the characters in the previous book, you get to meet them again. It's like, woohoo, because I like these people. Then again, some of the characters who died in the last book, and it was that you got this real great sense of sacrifice, that they died and they gave their life for the cause, or they were killed in this tragic way or something like that. You really like those characters, and you got that whole sense of sacrifice because they were characters you really like and they were killed off at the end. But now you get to spend more time with them because they've been brought back to life here. And again, I like that kind of like, oh, we get double the value from these characters. We get to kill them and feel sorry for them, and we get to read about them again. Anyway, let's get back to these. Yeah, more planets. And there's wormholes as well, but these external worlds, the worlds on the edge of, like, the internal Commonwealth of worlds, they've started to reject the wormhole technology because there's too much of a monoculture happening. It's like, okay, because you can get from one planet to the next, and information you can get from one planet to the next, and fashions and technology, everything just goes from one planet to the next so easily. It becomes a monoculture, and they say, no, we want diversity in the human race. So the external worlds are set up as sort of like these, you know, there's vastly different levels of technology and vastly different types of society. And I really like all of that because, you know, if it is just one monoculture, if it is just like the one thing that you have there, it can get a bit boring to read. And the variety in this book is quite, you know, quite astounding of actually how many different cultures you can get across within one universe. It's a real delight to read there. And of course, there's vastly different levels of technology as well. I just mentioned that too. But they're all way ahead of us now. More about technology in a little bit. I guess the humans, of course, they've developed. You get your baseline humans, just like us, but still access to mind cores, you know, and being able to have long lives as well. So even the baseline humans aren't really that baseline. Then you get the Hyers. That's a faction, or that's a type of people who have sort of built in technology, like a constant connection to the information network around the galaxy. And then on top of that, you've got Advancers, who sort of take the next step. They're like massively inbuilt technology with like weapon systems built into them, and they can go into areas where, you know, there's massive like radiation or something like that, or big, you know, a lot of harm can come to them, and they just survive through. And if they get hit by something, their body has sort of repairs itself as it goes along, rather than actually having to have like re-life to actually get yourself younger again. Your body will do that for you. And then at the highest level, of course, there's the ANA. Now, I can't actually remember what the ANA stands for, but it's a big computer network kind of system where you can upload your memories into it. And you can actually choose to, in the future, download your memories again from it. And I really like this because you don't actually spend any time in the ANA. The first person that you meet is Justine, who is actually a character in one of the previous books. And she downloads her mind back into her old body again. And she's like, oh, it's so slow. I can't believe how long it takes to think about all this kind of stuff. And you never actually go inside the ANA to talk to the people there. Everything that happens in the world takes place through human agents. So there's factions within the ANA, and they use human agents to do their dirty work around the galaxy, or around the Commonwealth and in the external worlds and things like that. And again, I really like that because it could have too easily become, it's just like, okay, we're going to go into the virtual reality and we're going to, you know, have massive abilities in this kind of world. And it doesn't do that. It keeps it very much at a human level. The ANA, like I say, has factions within it. They don't know what each other were doing, but then there's ANA governance, which is like an accumulation, kind of amalgamation of every, like a composite of every personality and faction within the ANA itself, and that's called ANA governance. And it's sort of like a democratic representation of the ANA, but it doesn't know what the individuals are thinking. It doesn't know what the individual factions are doing or what they're talking to among themselves like that, but it can sort of represent it as a whole, and that's pretty cool. And there's different factions inside. Some of them want to push towards post-physicality or post-singularity, and others don't. They want to sort of keep things as they are and let humans still come inside. Because if they go into this sort of post-physicality, the humans who are already there won't be able to get in because they, you know, it would immediately advance way beyond human comprehension to the statehood of godhood, I guess. The status of godhood. Like I said before, people migrate inward. So what happens is that when people get older, they get fed up with life and they actually go in towards the inner planets. And Earth is, of course, at the center. And Earth only has a few hundred thousand people living on it physically, and everyone else is in the ANA. And as you go out from the planets, go out sort of into the outer worlds and into the outer layers of these different planets, they become more and more populated. So on the edges, you've got millions upon millions of people per planet. And on the inside, you've got a few. So when people migrate inwards, they'd go up from baseline human to advanced, and then up to higher, or whichever way around it is, and then into the ANA. So I quite like that idea too. I mentioned before, there's this network. Again, I'm not actually talking much about the story here because, again, I don't want to spoil it. So I'm talking more about the technology and the world here because I just really love it, spending time in this in the world of Peter F. Hamilton. They're always like fantastically well portrayed. You get these like this internet kind of thing. It's not an internet. And I do actually like this better than sort of like a single idea of the internet, like in Snow Crash, where it's the metaverse. It is one thing. It has one protocol, and it doesn't exist outside of that. What happens in this is that you're talking about it sort of like, oh, it's all hashed together, and it actually mentions at one point there's so many different systems, but they all manage to talk to each other somehow. And I really like that. It is like the internet. You know, my computer is a Mac, but then there's another computer over there, which is a PC. It doesn't matter what individually they are. There's sort of like this framework between them which lets anything talk to anything, or most things talk to most things quite well. And the way that people interact with it, the people in the real world interact with it, is something called the U shadow. And the U shadow is like this, it's not something physical, but it's sort of there, and you interact with it on a mental level. You can, and it can display things for you, but it's not part of you. It sort of like shadows you as well. And it's quite a cool thing there. It's not like, okay, everyone is constantly connected all the time. You can be constantly connected all the time, but you sort of train your shadow to connect for you. So you walk into a room and you want some food. You just think, oh, I'm hungry, and it'll automatically know if you're hungry enough that you actually want food now. It's sort of like it's trained to do things like the private things for you. It like works on an instinctive, like basic level kind of thing. And I actually really like this idea because I see that's the way that computers are going now. Like when I turn my computer on, it's quite easy to train. It's just some settings there, but it opens the programs that I want straight away. So I turn on my computer, it opens iTunes straight away, it opens up Firefox, it opens this and that, and Firefox then I've trained that to take me to the websites that I want, and I've trained iTunes to, you know, it automatically downloads files for me, and then when I finish listening to them, it automatically knows that I finished listening to it. I've played it all the way to the end, I've finished the file of the podcast, and it deletes it for me. And, you know, I never actually have to worry about this kind of thing. It's just trained it. And I actually see this U shadow as being like one of the ultimate extensions of this. It's like you've lived with it for so long. It's just a shadow that sort of hangs around with you, that it knows what you want and can give you news when you need it. And you can use it to connect to things. And yeah, it's sort of like that idea is a key idea. And it didn't talk about the technology behind it, didn't talk about the format, again, like Snow Crash did. Snow Crash is like, ah, the world is based on base 2. You know, everything is a multiple or a factor of 2. And I'm like, ah, oh, yeah, great, that's good. So that's good. Oh, another good thing about it is Ozzy invented the wormhole later on, with a little bit of input from some alien race. He invented the Gaia field, or the Gaia field. And that's sort of like, everyone's got a receiver in their brain, and there's sort of like different nodes which remember what people transmit, and everyone receives stuff at the same time. So if people are, you know, thinking lots of things at the same, if lots of people are thinking at the same thing, lots of, try that, say that again. If lots of people are all thinking about the same thing at the same time, that becomes like a top thought in the Gaia field, and everyone else, you know, thinks that at the same time, or, you know, is told that at the same time, then they think about it. So it's sort of like a continual moving kind of idea, like a group consciousness in a way. And for this, the parallel I bring back to this, back into the real world internet now, is a bit like, I guess, Twitter, where everyone is twittering about this, you know, but it's sort of like instinctive twittering, where you never actually have to think about it. Sort of like this microblogging. I'm thinking about this. I'm doing this. I'm doing this. I'm watching this. And everyone, if you know, if enough people are all going, oh, I'm watching this, you go, oh, maybe I should be watching that. And it's sort of like that kind of, but it happens in the background, you know, at the back of your mind. You know, you've got a receiver in your head, and it's sort of sitting there, and it's just like a constant thing. If everyone's happy, it makes you happy. Yeah, that's pretty cool. A pretty cool idea there, too. So anyway, enough about technology. Let's get into some of the basic plot, 20 minutes into the view. Again, I'm not going to go into any detail here. The last book, after the last book, sorry, aliens contained, aliens defeated, pretty cool there. So they've got all these new starships. Yeah, because in the last book, it was mainly, at the beginning, it was all wormholes, but then over the course of it, they developed starships. Humans had never needed starships because they just opened a wormhole where they needed to, and it's like, okay, now instead of spending all this energy and only opening a wormhole nearby, we're going to take one of these spaceships, go for a trip around the galaxy. So 1,500 years before this book takes place, someone takes a trip around the galaxy, and they discover what's called the void, which is the black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's not a black hole, by the way. Not in this book. It's this super huge, ancient, advanced entity sort of created by some ancient, super advanced alien race. And it's sort of like this thing that sits there and you can't get inside of it. And I can't really explain it very well, but it's just this thing that sits there and you can't touch it. Because if you touch it, or if you approach it, or if you attack it in any way, it expands and actually draws in matter, like a black hole would, a supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy would. And it would suck it in, and it's sort of like, it's very destructive and dangerous for the galaxy as a whole, for anyone to go near it even. Except, as we find out very soon in the book, at some point in the past, a human craft actually got through and survived. Nobody outside of the void noticed at the time, but that's what happened. Yeah, let's fast forward about 1,000 and so years, and this guy, this human called Inigo, he goes near to the void, into a base there, an alien base quite near to it, to study it. And he has these strange dreams. And it turns out these dreams are coming out of the void, because this void is this huge singularity kind of thing. It's obviously in some way intelligent, or contains intelligence, or contains the essence of intelligence in some way, and it's very, very powerful. We're not quite sure what's going on there, but Inigo starts getting dreams from it, okay? And other people can share his dreams through the Gaia field. So he starts this kind of movement dedicated to studying the dreams and trying to connect again with the dreams coming from the void. And it becomes a type of religion. And the plan is one day to gain access into the void and see if humans can once again cross into the void. Because only humans can do it. No other aliens seem to have been able to do this. But humans seem to, of course, by previous experience, seem to maybe could get into the void safely, but we don't actually know that for a fact. So this religion movement, it actually takes over, it becomes like the state religion, like a theocracy kind of situation on a few of the worlds. That's the basic setup. The beginning of the book, Inigo disappears and other people take over this movement, this religious movement of dreamers. And then a bit later, a second dreamer, somebody else who dreams, is detected in the Gaia field. And it's decided that this means, of course, that the entity or the humans inside the void are trying to contact the humans outside of the void. And so the idea is that there's going to be a pilgrimage to the void. Again, this is all set up within the first, 20 pages of this book. It really just cut straight through it, and you really get down to the meat of the matter straight away there. Of course, if the humans do approach the void into a pilgrimage, maybe it'll set off one of these big destruction events where it'll be very dangerous for the entire galaxy. Maybe the whole galaxy will disappear into the void. So some factions want to stop the dreamers, this religion, setting off on this pilgrimage. And other peoples don't mind about that, and some aliens want them to stop, and other aliens don't seem to care at all. So some factions of the ANA and other human factions want to stop this going ahead, and other want it to, carry on. The thing is, at the same time, other factions are wanting to stop those other people stopping, not because they want the pilgrimage to go ahead, but for other reasons that were never actually revealed in this book, or not near the beginning of the book as well. And then there's other factions trying to work out what these people are doing, and then there's other factions who, because these other factions are doing things illegal, they want to stop what's going on there as well. And then there's other people doing things in the book, and you're not quite sure what they're doing for, but it's not connected to the void at all. It's for some other reasons. Maybe the advancer faction of the ANA want to go post-physical as soon as possible, and they want to sort of set the void up as like this event which will be the catalyst to push the ANA to the post-physical state that they want to go, and sort of force their hand in that way. But then, of course, some other factions are wanting to stop them do that as well. So, like I say, there's lots and lots of characters, lots and lots of things going on in this book, lots and lots of factions. It's all about power. That's pretty much the main theme. I might as well just get straight to the theme of this book here straight away. Sure, there's lots of things going on there. There's lots of, things about identity and memory and sexuality and alternative ways of living and all that kind of stuff. But the main theme that this book deals with is power. It literally drips off every page. It starts with, one guy sort of getting his dream. And then it goes to the handover of power between one faction, or one person, one leader of this religion to the next leader of the religion, and the person who's doing it, you know, is watching, and there's this whole, like, incident that happens between them. It's this real weird thing, actually, between Aaron, this main, one of the main characters here, and this other one, this other, this woman, and they just talk to each other. And then this woman that he talks to is never mentioned again. It's a great conversation. It just sets up the whole book really fantastically. It's great to read. But then I finished the book thinking, where did she go? And I'm thinking maybe she was another character in the book, but I just don't know what was going on there at all. But yeah, it's like it's just everything is about which faction is in control, and every situation, even like a character has sex with another character, it's not about the sexuality, it's not about the actual act, it's about who has power over the other person and how sex is used to gain power over somebody or not, you know. And it's just like literally all the time, and it's just amazing to read. Again, you could say, Luke, oh, you're reading too much of it. No, you're not. I mean, there's no way this book could have been written without Peter F. Hamilton not thinking, okay, this is going to be a book about people having power over other people, or, you know, people trying to gain power, or, you know, people rising to power and other people falling from power at the same time. It's just an amazing virtuoso performance on a single theme that is just so strong here as well. So getting to the characters, I mentioned Aaron before. He's my favourite character in here, and he's one of the main characters there's probably like 3-4 main characters in the book, and he's a mystery man, and he's a real mystery man, because we find out that he doesn't remember who he is. He just arrives in the situation and he goes, Who am I? I don't really know who I am. I know what I need to do. I have sort of a motivation, but I don't even know who I'm working for. And I loved this. This is a fantastic device. It's like, okay, if you don't know who you are, but you know what you want to do, does it matter who you're working for? And he actually says this. Like, someone says, who are you working for? He says, I don't know. And they're like, but what if you're working for here? It's like, doesn't matter. You know, I know that in the past I chose to work for this person. And the thing is, Aaron, you keep thinking, okay, who is he? And I think he might be one of the characters from the previous Commonwealth Saga books. They come back to sort of like in a different body, and you can, because he's like the real action man, you know. He's when the only action, or the only real sort of like man on man, gun on gun kind of action that takes place in the main universe here in this book. He's the guy who does it, and so he's quite a riveting character. But again, this whole sort of like identity memory kind of idea being explored with him, really, really great. And like I say, the action in this book is fantastic, especially this one scene, or this one sequence, where Aaron breaks into a memory bank. He wants to find some, you know, widget. Doesn't even matter what it is for this. And every frame, every moment is detailed. Time slows down. That he's literally fighting against these other entities. He's fighting against these other people at a molecular level. Literally, you know, he goes in, something happens, and they almost go down to, not molecular, a cellular level. Let me put it that way. And like 20 pages go past, and 3 minutes of time happens in 20 pages, and probably around about 10, 15 of those pages happen. It just recounts what happens for 30 seconds in the book, in the timeline of the book. And I'm thinking, wow, 20 pages. 20 pages for 30 seconds, or 15 pages for 30 seconds. And it was riveting stuff, and it was just like, oh, this happened, and this, and it's like every single bullet that comes towards him is sort of described in detail. And because, you know, he's an advancer human, you know, he's really, really advanced. He's got weapon systems coming out of his ears, literally. I mean, it's amazing. So that was a real cool thing. Next character, I guess, main character is Troblum, who's this weapons expert. He's trying to develop, he worked out this alien civilization, or this alien race must have used this kind of thing, and I think I've worked out the theoretical physics behind it, and I'm going to see if I can make something like that. So he's like this weapons expert who is working for, of course, one of the factions of ANA. He's a bit weird, a bit eccentric, a big fat guy, you know. He's a bit despicable, but he doesn't seem that eccentric throughout the book. He doesn't seem that strange until somebody else, he meets somebody, and somebody else introduces him, and he's introduced as something like this idiot savant with a Starfire war fetish. You know, he's sort of like a big freak about the events of the previous Commonwealth Saga books, and you know, he's described as not idiot savant, autistic. You know, he's like an autistic guy, and it's not mentioned up until that point, and then you just think, oh yeah, of course he makes a whole lot more sense now that I know that he's, like, you know, like autistic and just weird in that way. He doesn't fit in. He's not like a modern human like the rest of the people in this book are. He's a real set apart in that way. Next main character, I guess Paula Mayo, who was the main character from the previous book, she's from this world, or she was born on a world where everyone is genetically engineered to have, you know, to fit in their perfect place in that society. So a farmer is genetically engineered to be strong and big and to be able to work hard throughout the day, but isn't that bright, you know, but is happy with his level of intelligence. And doctors are very intelligent and they know this kind of stuff. And a teacher is a perfect teacher. They're genetically engineered to be a perfect teacher. Paula Mayo was actually genetically engineered to be a perfect policeman. Now, policemen weren't needed very much in this society that she comes from, in this planet that she comes from, because everyone was genetically engineered and put in their perfect place in this perfect society, so crime didn't happen very much. But the policemen were super cool. She was kidnapped by some protesters who thought this sort of, like, this ultra-fascist kind of society was really bad, and she was taken away to sort of liberate her, but it didn't liberate her. She was just, like, a complete fish out of water. She's, like, this genetically engineered super investigated policewoman, and in the last book she, like, really earned her stripes and she becomes one of the most powerful security kind of operatives in this book, and she works directly for ANA governance, the top level of the ANA. So she does quite stuff. She's actually mellowed out quite a lot since the last book, like on purpose. She mellows herself out. She actually, when she becomes young again, when she re-lifes herself or re-youths herself, she changes her genetics. So that's quite an interesting little thing there about, you know, identity. Like, Aaron doesn't know anything about his past identity, and he doesn't know anything what's happening at all. He doesn't know where he comes from. Paula Mayo knows exactly where she comes from, down to, like, the genetic level, and yet she's happy with that and is changing it. And it's really great because, you know, we get to spend time with her, just like, she's just on the starship going from one planet to the next, and she just takes out a guitar. She's like, oh yeah, and it sort of tells you, oh, she's getting into music. And it tells you about how she's, like, getting into playing her guitar. Really kind of refreshing stuff. And I love how the book, because it's so long, you can really get to know the characters, like, in such a deep level. Yeah, that's cool. Araminta is this young girl. She's a property developer. Oh, she goes through a divorce and she becomes a property developer. And she's like the only character that we actually meet in this book, in the sort of Commonwealth universe in this book. I'll get onto why I keep saying that in a second. She's the only one who isn't, like, an agent, a high-level agent for a faction, or isn't sort of a big mover or shaker. She's just, like, this random young girl, and she has time to do stuff because she isn't continually working and fighting and investigating and influencing and wheeling and dealing. She has time to fall in love and have fun and go out and meet guys and experience the world and learn the world. And she's really our connection, or one of our connections to, like, one of the outer planets, so one of the, like, non-core planets where, she the technology level that she deals with is much, like, more basic than other people. She's, like, a lot more grounded, and she's our stepping stone into this world in a way. And that's her main role in this book. She doesn't have any other role or influence on the other characters, except in one way. Like I said before, there's this second dreamer. Another person is getting dreams out of the void. It's her. Of course it's her. I mean, because you get this, like, once you work out there's a second dreamer, you realise it's her straight away, because that's her only function in the book, and everyone else has a function already. So, and she doesn't know she's the second dreamer, which, again, is quite an interesting little thing in the book, because everyone's looking for her, and she doesn't know that everyone's looking for her. She doesn't even know that anyone's looking for anyone, which is quite a cool thing. So, yeah, she meets lots of people, has lots of sex. It's a really interesting character there. Other characters come and go. You sort of, like, meet this person, you spend a bit of time with them, and then they go again. But those characters that I talk about there, just talked about, are the main ones. The cool thing, like, say, because it's a long book, even these smaller characters, you might only spend 20 pages of them, 15 pages of them, but in that time, they're just so key, and you get to know them so well. It's just like, wow, this is, like, every single character in the book is there. And like I said before, a huge strength of Peter Hamilton's work Because, I just love spending time with his characters. It's like a soap opera in a way, that you're just going, oh, I wonder what's going to happen here. And then you leave them, and you come back to them in the next chapter, and then you leave them, and you come back to them like 20, 40, 50 pages later, and they've done a bit more, and you're seeing how things go along. Just a fantastic thing. The complete opposite of the book that I read the other day, Down the Bright Way by Robert Reed. That was like all the characters experiencing the same thing at the same time. This is, like I said, the opposite example in that way. Everyone's experiencing different things, yet the story's all coming together into one thing. Finally, the last character that we meet and the last world that we go inside of is that we actually get to read about Inigo's dreams, the first dreamer. What did he dream? Well, we get to read those dreams as he goes through, and his dreams are telling the story of something happening on a planet or on some kind of planet, on a world inside the void. And the main person that we follow is a young boy, or I say a young boy, a teenager called Ediard, and he's like this young, talented boy who sculpts animals, because the world that they're living on inside the void, you realise quite soon that it's not actually like a physical world, or the normal rules of physics don't apply there. It's obviously some kind of matrix world, or some world which is controlled at the lowest level by micro nanobots or something like that. I'm not entirely sure if it is a matrix world, or if it's sort of like a normal world with laws of physics suspended in some way. Maybe, I don't know, maybe there's not a difference between those two things. And I say it's a matrix world because the people in the computer simulation world, they don't know they're in the computer simulation world. They just think they're on a planet. But because it's all they know, and it's because it's all they've ever known, they don't see anything wrong with it. But they're all telepathic, and they're all telekinetic. They can move things with what they call their third hand. And the third hand is just sort of like their one implement that they can use to manipulate things telepathically, telekinetically. And I really like this because it's a real sort of parallel to the U-Shadow. In the main universe of the book, you get the U-Shadow, and in the Inigo's dream universe, or the one set on his planet, you get the third hand and the telepathy there. And anyway, Ediard, he leaves the country with his job in the country, and he goes and makes his way in the city. And at the end of the book, of course, by that time, he has had quite a big impact in the world, or in his city that he's living in at the moment. But it becomes a real Neo moment. You know, I say like Neo at the end of the first Matrix film. It's sort of like, there is no spoon. It's like, ah, there is no spoon. You can see it coming a mile away. It's like set up right at the beginning of the book that he's going to be Neo. He's going to become this kind of Christ figure in this book, there you go. The whole book is, because it's all sort of like telepathy kind of stuff, it's like a real fantasy world that's set up. Not a true magic here, this, that, there, wizard swords and sorcerers and things like that, but magic does exist in sort of like a very real form. It's a real fantasy book. It could almost work as a standalone novel, like a standalone short story or novella, just those parts. I say maybe because I think it only works because you know that by the end of this huge trilogy, Ediard is going to have not just an impact on his world, but on the galaxy as a whole. Not just his world, but the void, and then the Commonwealth, and every alien species that exists in the galaxy. Something that he's going to do is going to affect all of them, and that's what you're building towards. You know, the rest of the book is setting up what Ediard is going to become in the future. And I think without that, you know, wider picture, I wouldn't have enjoyed it so much. But all the time you're thinking, okay, he's gaining this bit of power. Oh, he's discovered this about the world. Oh, he's discovered this about himself. Oh, he's done this. Oh, he's done that. And you can sort of see it really building. And of course, at the end of this book, it's, you know, just on that turning point of where it's obviously going to accelerate through the next books there. This world, though, because everything is set up this in this sort of like telepathy kind of telekinesis way, everything, you know, people use swords and they use guns. I mean, guns do exist, but modern transport doesn't exist, modern communication doesn't exist. It takes a year for him to travel from his town out in the sort of like redneck town out in the back of beyond somewhere into the main city there, and he travels on a caravan to get there, you know, horse-drawn caravan. The cool thing about this that I really like, another little layer of technology in this other world, is all the technology is based on animals, and these animals are sort of grown in eggs, but the telepathic humans, the people called egg sculptures, sculpt what kind of animal is going to come out of this egg and what it's going to have in real life. Is it going to be like a horse and pull stuff? Is it going to be a dog and fight stuff? Is it going to be a cat, like a cat, and chase stuff? Is it going to be a bird and fly places and stuff like that? And it's all determined by thinking hard about what's inside the egg. And that was really cool. I like technology based on biology in a way. Other technology actually set out in the other stuff. I guess I've already mentioned like the world or the galaxy wide network that goes on there. Again, I don't want to go into too much detail. Oh, spaceships and weapons and things like that. Thing is, that I don't like about Peter F. Hamilton's world is that often, if something is possible, if he thinks about it, he suddenly goes, "Oh, that's a good idea," and he puts it in the book. And I think his books sometimes suffer for that. Like by the end of the book, the technology is so out there, it's just like, oh, well, if this is possible, anything is possible. And then anything is possible. Like, you know, I sometimes just want that little bit of boundary there. In this book, it's set up that, okay, there is a boundary. People don't have money, but they have energy and matter credits, you know, in the inner world, that is, energy and matter credits. And you think, okay, this is going to set it up so the people in the inner world have to go by these rules. But no, that's just sort of like set up in the first few pages, and then like two chapters in, it's discarded, and this doesn't seem to be that boundary there. And then another technology will come along, like, oh, he's got a mini black hole that you can control by magnetic fields and dissolve stuff and suck stuff in and then throw it away. It's just like, oh, okay. And everyone else in the book is going, oh, wow, I didn't know this was possible. And I'm not going, oh, wow, I didn't know that was possible. And it just seems to be thrown out there. And it doesn't need to be invented. It just needs to be thought up for it to be possible. And again, I just want that extra little boundary in Peter F. Hamilton's books there. Oh, one final bit of technology that I must mention is the house. I really, really love the house that one person visits, because it's like this big bubble, hundreds of meters across. And it's just a bubble. And you go in and you stand in a bubble. And then when you want to go to another room, that bubble moves through the house and goes next to another room, and you just walk through a door from that bubble into the other bubble. And then if you want to get from that room to any other room in the house, they just bubble around inside the bubble, and then you just walk through the door, connecting door between them. And I really like this. Again, just in the last episode that I did, episode 29 and a half, I was talking about how the internet isn't a physical place, because from any place on the internet it takes one link to get anywhere else, whereas in Second Life, to get from one place to anywhere else, you've got to go through other places. You've got to go out a door, through down a corridor, out another door, into a street, across the street, onto a bus, on the bus down here, across that, you know what I'm trying to say there. Whereas everybody's house is set up in that way. Whereas the house in this book, even though it's not like explicitly stated, it's just described quite well. It's just like, oh wow, that's like a house, which is just at a point-to-point network. Like, it's like a web. Every room in the house is connected immediately to another room in the house, which I thought was really, really cool. There's a great book, actually, like a short story about a book. I can't remember. It's sort of like The House That Collapsed on Itself, and about how someone builds a house which is a tesseract, like a four-dimensional cube, and you go into it and you can go from any wall. You go through this wall and you end up in this room. It felt like that, but like a physical embodiment. And the best thing about it, the technology behind this house, you could probably do it now, actually. It reminds me of, like, you know, those garages where you put your car in and you park your car in it, and then it goes and takes your car somewhere like that. It's like, imagine one of them, but every car is a separate room, so to get from one room to another, it just goes, I'm walking towards this door to get to that one, and oh, my U-shadow's told him where I want to go, and it's, oh, I'm there already. And they just walk from one place to another. Like, it's like a post-physical house, or post-physical location house kind of thing. Anyway, I think that pretty much wraps up my review of the book. Not so much a review of the story or anything like that. I'm certainly looking forward to the next book. I'm not looking forward to the end of the last book, I think, because it's probably going to, you know, someone will just become a god, and using their powers of god, they'll just put everything right, and everything will go back to going, oh, great, like that. Sort of happens in Peter F. Hamilton books sometimes. It's a bit disappointing. The journey to get to that disappointing point will certainly be worth it. The characters are fantastic. The plot is fantastic. And there's more ideas in, like, one chapter of this book one section of this book than the whole of a book like Snow Crash. Again, going back to the last episode that I talked about Snow Crash. Like, for example, in this book, in the Inigo's dream world, Ediard, or whatever his name is, he's like in a world where people are telekinetic. They can move things in their mind. So you're thinking, okay, a padlock. So what are you going to do with a padlock? Okay, it's not just going to be something, oh, you stick in a physical key and turn, because you could just go, I'm going to stick my mind in there and just turn it. So, like, one of the characters, Edyard, just comes across a padlock, and it just says, oh, it was a padlock so complicated to stop, you know, to stop any, even the most expert telekineticist, whatever that word would be. And it's like one line, and it's just like, okay, in that one line, he's just explained everything that needed to be explained about the society and privacy in this society, and, you know, what it'd be like to live in that society and how to have property in that society. And all he did was explain it by oh, this character noticed this padlock or walked up to this padlock, and that was it. And that's all you needed to say. And it's like, wow, the whole world just falls into place by that one comment. And then, of course, he goes on. And in that one passage, there's sort of like 8 or 9 really core ideas that just express a fantastically well-developed world there. And it's not driven in it. It's not like, okay, this person is here and this is based on this and this is this and that's that and this is this and that's that. And that doesn't actually advance the story at all. It's like, by advancing the story, by just putting something in a character's way, you can just flesh out the world and advance the story at the same time. And that's what I like about it. It's like, I don't want to, like, separate concept and character and plot. Everything has to be there. I don't want to separate concept and art and literature. It just all has to sort of, an entertainment, it all just has to sort of fall into its lap. It, like, just fall together into a perfect whole. And that's what this book is for me. So I'm going to give this book 4 stars out of 5. Again, I'd give it a higher score, I guess, but I don't think I want to give a book which is just a first book in a series, which is a follow-on from another series, a higher score than that. Because, again, I think maybe I'm enjoying it more because it's already characters I know in a world that I know, and there's more to come, so I'm anticipating it as well. So I think I sort of my enjoyment, or how I'd actually enjoy the book, has been artificially inflated by it being part one of a book, and I'm just like, ooh, part two coming up soon. So I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 because that's what I think it's worth, although enjoyment factor probably a little bit more than that, just because the characters are so cool and the technology is so cool. So there we go. Again, another longer episode here, it's good to do a longer episode about a book I really like and can be really enthusiastic about, rather than a book which is just me ranting about stuff that I don't like. Hopefully the good books, my reviews of the good books, are just as interesting as the reviews of the bad books, so it's not just me ranting all the time. Yeah, and I said I didn't even have enough. I said I didn't have a lot to talk about in this book. How wrong I was. It turns out I had a lot to say about it, just not a lot to say about the plot itself. Next book that I'm going to read, Neuromancer by William Gibson. I've got it right here. I haven't started reading it yet. I've only just finished the Peter Hamilton book here. So it's the book of the year, win of the Hugo, Nebula and Philip K. Dick Awards, and I have read it before. It's just that after my disappointing experience with Cyberpunk on the last book, Snow Crash, I'm going to give a go a book that I remember enjoying quite a bit, even though I did read it 12, 13, 14 years ago. So, like I say, if the concepts might be dead in this book to me, might be well out of date, but if it's a good book, I'm still going to enjoy it, and that's my test of Cyberpunk, you know. Is someone actually going to, you know, this is a very short book as well. It's only a few hundred pages long. So, yeah, another review coming soon, uploaded once I get home. So, if you've enjoyed this podcast, if you enjoyed the review, email me, luke@juggler.net. If you've not enjoyed the podcast and you've not enjoyed it, also email me. Don't just unsubscribe. Tell me that, you're annoying and you stumbled too much. Yeah, the thing is, at the moment, it is quite late at night. It is around about 2 o'clock in the morning, and jet lag is getting to me, so at various times I'm not sleeping. You know, the clocks go back an hour every night. It's just like, great. Yeah, sorry about some of the stumblings that I had here as well. Leave your comments on the sfbrp.com wiki, and you can find out more information about that. And also soon, because I've got a bit more time on my hands on these gigs, I'm actually typing up some of the transcribed notes from the previous podcast. So if you're interested to see, like, to reference back or search what I might have said about something, I'm going to start putting on the full transcripts or the full abbreviated transcripts of the podcast that I've done in the past. So anyway, that's all I need to say now. So catch you next time.